ับค่ะ
They would tell what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, and it's supposed to be just that simple, isn't it? I will identify a little bit. I had a mixed up childhood. I don't know if that was the cause of me being an alcoholic. I don't think so. I think whiskey is strictly the cause of that, that first drink. But we do have cute personalities, all of us are a little different. But when I was 3 years old and my brother was 5, my daddy kidnapped us and brought us south to his sister in Lumpkin, Georgia. And I can remember just enough that I was taken away from my mother. And got adjusted to this aunt and uncle. And that adjustment, about 2 years later, when I was about 5 and my brother 7, my daddy remarried and was living in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, and he took us. Amen. When I was old enough then, I didn't want to be separated from this aunt. And I didn't know anything about stepmothers. I really didn't. I didn't dislike my stepmother just because she was a stepmother. I just adore her today. She lives right here in Albany with my dad here. But evidently, I don't remember things I did to her, but it must have been pretty rough because after 2 weeks living with my dad and my new mother, I'm choking to death. Daddy didn't realize that, and Martha was grieving over me, and he knew I was over her, so he wrote her, and it was just 2-3 months ago, back in summer, last part of the summer, that I read this letter. That, I never did want to read it, and Martha kept it all these years, that my daddy wrote her and said, now we have got to do something about June. We can control Marvin because she had a son by a previous marriage who was my age. And he and my brother got along pretty good at the time. And my brother was a little more easily adjusted. He wasn't as attached to Aunt Martha as I was. He says, I'll bring her to Lumpkin and we will decide. And then in the question mark there, he says, what about the Methodist orphanage in Macon? And shivers went down my spine just a few months ago when I read it and thought, well, oh, but for the grace of God. But of course, when he brought me to Lincoln, I was there from then on. Now, you know, when I sit in an audience and somebody's talking, I was told by my sponsor always to give you sobriety day. And he says, hell, when you're giving that, you might as well give your birthday, too. He says, because everybody sits there and wonders how old you are. You know, I do the same thing. I did that just the other night, the night before last in Cumberland. I was listening to this beautiful speaker, and I was caught myself wondering how and what difference did it make how old you are. But I was wondering. So I was born in 1920, and you subtract that from 1979, and that would make me 49 this June. That's my age. And I haven't seen fit, with the help of you in this program, to have had a drink since I came into AA on March the 10th of 1960. And I've been one of those blessed ones. I really wanted this program. And I did profit by a lot of your mistakes I remember there was a fellow at Cuthbert, bless his heart, he still comes on very rare occasions. That was sober 2 years when I came in, and he got drunk. And I asked my sponsor, I said, Ted, what in the world am I going to do? And he said, what do you mean? I said, he's drunk. And he said, well, you want to get drunk too? I said, I don't know what to do. He's got drunk, no people got drunk once they got in here. So I started learning pretty fast and applying them sticks to my life so that maybe I wouldn't slip either. But I had a time, you'll hear that later, after I got in the program, trying to make the program, especially this first year. Now, going back again, I have such mental blocks. I go and come and go and come. I'm glad other people do it, though. I grew up never wanting for anything. I didn't realize there was a depression. I was old enough to know. My uncle was the banker, and he had a dab of this and a hand in everything. He was an undertaker, and had a furniture store and a filling station, and I don't know. He had his hand in every large farming industry and the cotton warehouse there, and I didn't realize when they were struggling along that they were sacrificing for me until whenever it was in 31 or 2 that the banks closed. And I never saw him shed a tear, but I remember him sitting on the back porch that one afternoon. They had closed the bank, which didn't mean anything to me at all. I didn't rest it. But I saw the tears rolling down his cheek. And, of course, it was 3 days later that the bank was open. And I can remember years later, maybe 6, 8 years later, that the bank was robbed in the night. And I can remember the terrible feeling that I had, that I wonder if Austin's going to cry. My uncle called him Austin. If Austin was going to cry this time, because it really impressed me. And I began to realize that they were sacrificing for me, and I didn't measure up. So I grew up feeling more or less an indebtedness toward them for what they were doing for me, and I didn't want to ever disappoint them. And I remember when I went to Millersville to school, I always had school on that. When I did go to college, that I wrote letters home about some of the girls up there that were drinking. And the evils of alcohol, and you never need worry about me. In fact, one of the girls from Lumpkin was drinking that went to school at the same time I did. And I didn't like it. And I grew up really in a good Christian home. They didn't drink, and they were church-going people. And you know, Mae, when I was talking about it coming down tonight, I said, I think we're blessed people. We laugh the kid a lot about being raised in a Christian home. And we stray away from it, but you know, we always will come back to it. You can remember that, those of you who have it. The children, don't send them to Sunday school, take them. Because if we do stray away from it, sometime in our life, no matter what it is, if it's alcoholism or what, I think that we come back, always come back to the good. I believe that. I not only was raised in the church, I loved my church. I still do. And I loved my church so good that I even went right up to the bitter end with alcohol on my bread. And I can remember the resentment that I had that told the last when people would turn around and I'd right back in the face. But I went. But before I did get so bad, I taught a Sunday school class. And I was active in the missionary work there. And we had a dynamic Sunday school teacher. And she made me chairman of one of the circles, and it just upset me to death. And I'd have to read a part or memorize something, you know, and I just couldn't hold the paper. And she said, just don't ever, and let me give you some advice. It's been pretty good in AA, too. Don't ever let your audience know that you're nervous. She says, because if you do, they get nervous. And they don't hear anything you say. So I've tried to not let y'all know that I'm nervous. And she's the woman that, when I did get into the very depths of alcoholism, I called one night about 2 o'clock and asked her what she was doing. And she said, well, I had gone to bed. And I said, oh, I wanted to talk about the Sunday school place. But I'll talk to you tomorrow. Oh, the next morning at daylight the telephone rang. And I said, June, what in the world do you mean calling Miss Abby at 2 o'clock in the morning? And I said, who said I did? And she said, Miss Ada called me and told you did. I said, well, she told you a lie. But you know, it was along about in then, too, that I was forgetting bad. Now, when I came home from college, my uncle put me in the bank. And there I was for 25 years in the bank. Well, I had the bank was on the corner, and my restaurant motel was next door. And I was doing some bookkeeping on the side. And my restaurant was flourishing. So I gave up banking after 25 years and took that over until I went broke and moved on the corner and I made jet for a living. But, see, I've had that one of those mental blocks back up a little bit here. I've really got one. Oh, I didn't want to disappoint them. And I was a pretty good little old gal. And I was working in the church and I was doing this. And I was going out with a crowd that drank and I didn't drink. Didn't want to drink. I'd drive them home. And so I started going with this man, Van Lumpkin, who had been married. And that was bad enough. But he was the town drunk. And I married him. At the age of 25, I was 25 years old. Well, that put him off the bed and brought the Methodist minister to the house. And they cried and they prayed about a week. But now this man told me, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I was, by this time, I was drinking a little socially at the such thing, and it was then with me because I could drink tonight and leave it off tomorrow night. That was, I would say, the beginning maybe of my drinking. Before I married him, though, I was about 22 years old when I did drink a little socially. And I drank with him the same way. But I didn't know what DTs were. But I knew before I married him that he had DTs. And I knew that they had sent him to Bronx Sanitarium on numerous occasions because he went crazy and saw bugs and they couldn't keep him in the house. And I remember passing that house and feeling so sorry for his mother because that son was crazy and I told him I'd married him. I know I passed that one day going to school. He was 14 years old when I was going to school one morning and he was crazy as a bat and stuck in newspaper all around the windows, you know. It was a pretty sunny day, but he thought it was raining. And he was keeping the rain out of the house. And I remember how sorry I felt for that woman. But he told me when I married him that he would never drink again, so I believed him. So I married him. And after they got over that, of course, they took me back with open arms and accepted him. And in fact, his sister was my uncle's secretary for 20 years, Van Vang. So we settled down and we had a marriage. Well, after a couple of years of marriage, before that, though, we married in October of 45. And on Christmas Day, 3 months later, he got drunk. And I thought, well, now he told me he wasn't going to drink anymore. And I had not had any whiskey in the house. I gave up what little social drinking I was doing. And I didn't have anybody in the house that did drink. So it wasn't my fault that he got drunk. So a couple of months later, he went into these DTs. And I called my uncle. And I'll never forget him coming out about 4 o'clock in the morning and talking to Ken and telling him he should do something about it. And you know, he got up out of that bed and went to Bronx on his own. And was up there 10 days and came back, and for 13 years he never took another drink and died of a stroke in 59. Well, after a couple of years, he had been sober and on his feet and doing fine. He came in one day with a fifth liquor and put it on the kitchen table. He says, "I'm not going to drink anymore." And he said, "You enjoy your social drinks, and you come home from the bank tired, and I want you to enjoy it, and just don't worry about me, I'm not going to drink anymore." And he didn't. And I believed him. So I got awful tired from then on. And I'd come home every afternoon, and I never did fix many cocktails, but I'd drink it out of the neck of a bottle, and sometimes pour it in a glass and chase it with a little water. A lot of times I'd just drink it and get through with it and chase it with a cigarette. So this went on. Aggressively for about 10 years. I was getting a little bit worse and a little bit worse. So one afternoon in April before he died in June, I came in from the bank and I started right in the kitchen. He was sitting right at the door. He said, "Wait a minute, have you just got to have that drink?" And I said, "Well, no, I hadn't. Why?" And he said, "Well, I just want to talk to you a minute." And I said, "Well, I'll be back in a minute." And I choked up when I asked, "What you want to talk about?" He said, "I just want to tell you that if you ever feel like that you might be an alcoholic, will you promise me that you'll go to promise?" I said, "Yes, if that day ever comes, I will." Well, I was already getting bad enough then that I was taking tranquilizers and spirits of ammonia to kind of settle my hands in the bank. My first bag is getting kind of bad when he died. And, but I didn't really go into the very depths until he did die. And I really had a pity for him. But, after he died, I remember the night policeman, he lived in Albany now too. He was a lifelong friend of mine at the time, and I mean, he was a policeman at the time, and I remember just a few weeks after my husband was buried, I had no children. I kept that job at the bank, and I'd come straight home and get with a bottle, lock the doors. And that was every day, and it was then 3 pints from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until bedtime. But I would wait until dark. Now, I don't know of anything any more disgusting than a drunk woman, but did you ever see a lady drunk? Well, I'm one of them. I was really a lady drunk. No matter how much I had, I was always a lady. I'd lock myself in the house, and I'd make calls at that time, my brother in Japan. And I'd call him up, and I didn't even know I'd call him until I'd get the telephone bill. I had telephoneitis. I developed that after a while, too. But this particular time, right after Ken died, I'd get my bottle, and I'd get a glass, and then I'd make me a pitcher of ice water. And I'd go down to the cemetery, and I'd sit at the foot of his grave, and I'd get the glass and the pitcher of water and the whiskey, and that's it. And he came down there one night, and he did lay me. He says, "I don't know who in the hell you're trying to impress, but you're not impressing me." He says, "You get in that car and go home, and don't you ever find me down here anymore." He says, "Because don't you ever think I won't do it." He says, "Hell, I'll lock you up." And I believed him. So I didn't do that anymore. I didn't grieve anymore along those lines. I started having open house. I had open house every night. And all the boys I grew up with, I didn't grow up with any girls, they were all boys about my age. At that time, we were going to Eufaula. And all of this time, Ken had been buying my whiskey. Well, after he died, I was having a terrific time getting my whiskey. And they'd call the bank, and they said, "Train's going to Eufaula, how many?" Well, I knew if they were going to go, I'd say 12 or 15, because I knew they were going to have to drink it up, and they'd stay all night. And I'd get in the bank the next morning just as fresh as a daisy, hungover and shaky. And And we had an alcoholic doctor that had the best pink medicine you ever saw. I don't know what that meant. I'm still going to, and bless his heart, he died of alcoholism 3 years ago. And I don't know, I let him die without asking what it was. But there's a druggist over at Dobson that knows he filled it for me, and I'm going to find out he needs some too. He needs to take some too. Damn, he does. Bless his heart, but he filled that nerve medicine for me. But before Ken died, we got active in Sunday school work. And they had a Sunday school class there with, I believe, I said 12 a while ago, I believe it was 10 in the class. And very religious 10, a few, just 10. They were all very religious. And we decided we'd build up that class. And you know, we built that class from 10 to 60. And he was busy going all, everybody loved Ken. He was a person that everybody loved. And he would spend all during the week going all around town. I'd see it Sunday school Sunday. And then Saturday night, she'd say, I didn't see so-and-so and so-and-so. I'd be about half cocked, and I'd get on the phone and call them. And so it was a few of them there that were my drinking buddies. And I said, just come on, easy. I can't go. I shake too bad. I said, just come on by the house in the morning. A few minutes before Sunday school, I've got the best medicine for that you've ever seen. And you know, I had a 15 or 20 at my house before Sunday school every Sunday morning. Take a nerve medicine. And Mabel remembers her husband was one of them. I grew up with her husband too. And he came by, he says, I took some of that stuff last Sunday. He said, oh, it did calm me down. He said, that's good stuff. He said, I'm going to take a double dose today. And poor fool who went to sleep in Sunday school. And a lot of stuff. And it reeked with alcohol. We built it up. We had it up to 60 people, and that's better than being home hungover and not going to call. And that was why I was calling that Sunday school teacher at 2 o'clock in the morning, too. After she died, I wanted to talk to her about that Sunday school class that morning. But Ken used to gamble some, too. He loved to gamble. And there was a man from Alabama that used to come over on occasions that gambled with him. And after Ken died, this man, I had known him all through the years just as a casual acquaintance. And he came by the house one night when we were having open house. Some of them were playing my organ and some the piano, and some of us in the kitchen drinking, and it was scattered all around, even the bed. And I started dating this fella. As I said, I didn't really know him. And he asked me to marry him. And I thought, well, now, that's the best thing I can do. He'll get my whiskey from me, and he drinks. Ken didn't drink. And I'll have it made. Now, I married him on the 13th of December. And I didn't know until 10th of March that I was married to him. I don't remember too much marrying him. But I do remember coming home from Ozark, Alabama one night, and he passed out at the wheel. I just noticed the car was swaying. I looked over at him, and heck, he was passed out, and the car was just rolling along. I never did. The only thing I did, a good thing that I didn't do when I was drinking, I didn't drive and drink. I didn't stay in the road. But I took that wheel that night and got stopped right in the middle of Eufaula, going through a red light. And there he was, passed out. Then I told the man he was sick, and I was sorry, I was nervous. And of course, I knew you could smell my breath. I didn't have that much, though. I wasn't quite as fast as that stage. But he let me go. Well, I came home and I thought to myself, well, golly, I thought I was going to have it made. I remember thinking this, but now I'm married to a darn drunk. Well, it wasn't so good. Things weren't working so good. He was stealing my liquor. And I was stealing his whiskey. And when I was at the bank, he would give orders to all the servants at the motel and the restaurant over there not to let the whiskey come on that premises. He was not going to let me have the whiskey. I resented that. And I found out, I did one good thing, though, when I married him. He came from a lovely family. He had a brother who has built the home I'm in now as a contractor over at Ozark, and three beautiful, lovely sisters. I love them all today. And they're the ones that told me they was paranoid schizophrenic and was had been in a padded cell on three different occasions in Miami. Well, it just petrified me. And my drinking was bad. And you know, it was so bad when I would use the telephone at night, I would write down who I called. I had a habit, I'm a Methodist. And I had a habit of calling the Baptist preacher. And his wife. One would get tired of holding the phone and give it to his wife. And the wife would give it to him. I didn't know all this. I didn't know it was that bad until after I got sober. But I remember calling him, and I remember writing down everybody I called so that I wouldn't be embarrassed the next day. And I'd get up every morning and look, and I could not read my writing. It was just like a straight line. I could always see, tell brother, and the B, and then the Brian would go on out. But I knew I was calling them, so I tried my best to make up my mind I wouldn't call them. Of course, my mind would reverse that night. But one night, JT was passed out. And I don't know what, I do know too now, that it was God with me this particular night. I went to the telephone and called Dr. Brown. Now, you know, since I've been in AA, I have called him on several occasions. I either get answering service or have to talk to the nurse. It's just almost an act of Congress to reach him direct. But he answered that phone that night. And I told him that, well, wait a minute, I'll back up 2 weeks here. I left the bank and told him I had the flu. And I went home and I thought, well, I'm going to get sober. And I was afraid to quit because I remembered that Gann had DTs and I didn't want people lumping to see me crazy. They had just seen me drunk, but I didn't want them to see me crazy. So, I bought 12 pints. Now, those of you that know anything about a Hammond organ, you know that little back part's got a shelf right in back of it. It would hold a lot of pints back there. So I put some of them back there, and I had an upright piano. I knew I wasn't going to play the piano. So I put them up there, touch the piano, go ding, ding, ding all the way down the line. Then I took one pint, put it on the mantelpiece, and then I put one up under the mattress, and to the bed I go. And I called this lady, who both of her daughters I grew up with. One of them was the one I said a while ago was at Millville when I was at school. And she was a registered nurse and angel of mercy of Stewart County. I said, Miss Lillian, I want to see you. I'm fixing to quit drinking. And she said, well, bless your heart, honey, I'll be right up there. So she came up by and she said, the thing that stuck with me, she says, honey, I think you need medication. And I said, I think I can do it. I'm going to take it myself out. I said, now, we got that bottle up there on the mantelpiece, and I want you to come back this afternoon. So she came back that afternoon. I had gone in the organ a couple of times, and that bottle was still on the mantelpiece, and I said, how am I doing? She said, you're doing fine. Just fine. I was just as drunk as a coot. She said, I still think you need medication. And until you decide you need it, there's no point in me coming up here every few minutes because you know you're going to drink everything you got in the house, which I did. And it was when I got down to the very last bottle, and somehow I did, and JT passed out, I called Dr. Brown. And he, of course, told me later that he didn't believe me, but I told him that I thought I was an alcoholic, and I wanted to come to his sanitarium. And I witnessed blah, 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 about my husband had been up there, and he had cured him, 20 years ago. And so he told me that if I was there the next day by 3 o'clock, he'd have me a room. And if I was 1 minute after 3 or after 3 o'clock, that just forget it. So he didn't think I meant business. But you know, I had broken my Aunt Martha's heart. Now my uncle died in 55, and that was before I got too much into the debts about her. He knew I was drinking. He knew I was drinking too much. And that was the first of that ammonia. I was just taking a little ammonia then, and it would steady me at first. It would steady me all right in the daytime in the bank. But he said 2 or 3 times, honey, I think you're drinking too much. I know one time my wrist swelled up, and he said, leave off that alcohol, that wrist might not swell up. That was about the extent of it, but he died and didn't see me 2 or 3 years later when I got so much worse. But Aunt Martha did. I literally broke her heart. And the most vivid thing that I can remember before I went to Brown's was her coming down there one morning, and I had had open house, all, I had a case of whiskey, quarts, not fizz, quarts that night. And that was really a house full of folks. And when some of them started out the door, we lost the key, and I just got my foot and kicked the door, back door open, and it was half glass, and that glass busted. Glass went everywhere, all up in the trees, all over the steps, cut my leg, and cut it enough to where I had to call the doctor. Was down there to about 3 o'clock that morning, and this was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I had to get him out of a drunken stupor, get him back down there, put clamps in my leg, had a back cut on my leg. And everybody shooed away too when I cut my leg, scared them all to death. Well, I was by myself, and the doctor drunk put clamps in my leg. And she came down the next morning, and her face was white as a sheet. And she says, June, I would do anything in the world if you just would get sober. She said, anything in the world, and you should have the money. But she says, I would sell my home if it came to it. I would give everything I've got if you would get sober. And I looked at her and I said, get out. And I looked at the window, and the tears rolled down my cheek, and saw her walking with her hands behind her back. Trickled over the street she lived. With her heart broken and sobbing, and tears on down my cheek, and what in the world I had done to her. That prompted me along with, of course, God to call Dr. Brown. And you know, I went the next day, got JT sober enough to take me up there. And I was told by Kane and several others, before you go in, Dr. Brown, you better get well thought about. But I was scared to do it because I was scared this paranoid was going to put me in there for life. I didn't have any faith in him at all. And I still just realized I was just married to him, you know. So I didn't get thought about, but I walked in that place and signed myself in. And by the time I got to my room, they wouldn't let him even come up there because he was drunk as a hog. And I didn't even know it. He was too drunk to, much less to admit me. He should have been downstairs with the men then. And I got up to my room and told him that I came there to get well. And here he comes out in a day or two with his tail about 9 months. Stay 9 months, you know. I said, no, sir, I can't stay 9 months. If I can't get well before then, I've got to go home. And the doctor's wife was up there. And at this particular time, when I went up there in March, she had been there 10 months. So he figured, he found out Aunt Martha had some money. He'd already found that out before I got there, I reckon. Because he had me labeled for 9 or 10 months or a year. But he says, and maybe in May, when May comes, you can go in town to opera. Opera, hell. after the 4th or 5th day, now to show you how we work in this program, and I think it's beautiful, Donald Duffy from Albany called a lady, Neely, in Atlanta, and told Neely that June's daddy in Albany said that she'd gone to Brown's, and would she go out and talk to him. Dr. Brown comes up and tells me that this woman from Atlanta is coming out to talk to me from Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, no, I'm not interested in Alcoholics Anonymous or any other organization. They've got all I can do in the Methodist Church in London. And he said, well, now you told me that you would do anything we ask you to do, and that's one of the things I'm asking you to do. I said, all right, let her come on. And I told this lady, oh, I was a big shot. I had a nurse around the clock because I didn't want to go crazy by myself. So I had this nurse, and I said, under any condition, don't you leave this room when that lady comes out. And you know, once or twice while Neely was in there, the nurse got up, and I'd look at her right quick and set her back down, and Neely noticed that she knew what was going on. I don't remember a thing he said. Not a thing. I wasn't interested. All I was interested in was just getting home and staying sober a few weeks. Well, after 11th day, I was up there. I got ready to come home, and Dr. Brown said, well, I don't want you to go home, but if you're going, there's no point in staying there long. And he said, but you'll be back in 6 weeks. Well, that was when I made up my mind I was going to stay sober 8 weeks. I was going to prove to him I could stay sober longer than 6 weeks. Well, Neely left me some literature, but I didn't look at it. The nurse took it in my suitcase. So when I got home and unpacked, I was in pretty bad shape. As you know, just 11 days. And a drunk husband. And found out I was married to him. And Dr. Brown advised me to divorce him right away, but because if I didn't, this, that, and the other, which was good advice. My AA sponsor, Ted Norton, told me later he wished to God I'd have taken his, Dr. Brown's advice and divorced him. He liked to got Ted drunk. He really did. J.T. did. But I got home and had a letter for me. And in this letter, she had looked it up and had written, Eufaula, Alabama, 25 miles, AA. And the name, see, Jim Barr or Haywood Manor. They are both passed on since. Columbus, Georgia, 850 Broadway, Nick Martinetta. Lovely group. This is not too far either. Then she says, and then south of you is Cuthbert, Ted Norton. And they meet on Mondays and Thursdays. So all of it together, God speaking through her to me. I went straight to Eufaula first, because in my mind I figured I was in pretty bad shape, that I could go there to the meetings and get my whiskey there where I'd always gotten. So I went to Eufaula and I called these men, and they met me uptown, and they advised me to go to Cuthbert, that it was more active there. And at that time there was just those two in the group in Eufaula. So I came home and I called Cuthbert. And Catherine, Ted's wife, answered the phone. And I didn't know this until later. But Ted had just told her, before the phone rang, he says, Catherine, if any woman alcoholic ever calls me again, and I go out to help them, I want you to shoot me. He says, I ain't never gonna fool with another drunk woman. And the phone rang, and that was me. Catherine answered the phone, and I told her who it was, and that I thought maybe I wanted some help. And she said, just a minute. And I thought, my Lord. And she sounded so rough. And Ted came to the phone, and he hemmed and hollered a bit, and I thought, well, this. I said, are you the right one I'm supposed to call? And he said, yes, but we have a closed meeting tonight. I said, I don't care what you got, I'll be there. I wanted it. I wanted something because I was getting pretty bad shape. And J.T. was drunk that night. I came home from Brown's. Looks like he could have held back a little while. So off to Cuthbert I go by myself. But Ted turned to Catherine. Catherine said, now, what did you tell me a while ago? He says, I know what I told you. He said, but I think this woman means business. So that's how I got out of that. But poor little old Ted, for 8 years, the first 8 years, I did do everything he told me to do, and the main thing he said do is to call him. And I'd call him. I'd get to wanting a drink, and I'd get desperate. This cousin of mine, who I had resentment so long, because he died a year and a half ago. I don't have resentments now. But I sure did. I had him so bad that this is the truth. Some more work with God. He was in the hospital. He was doing better. This was August, this past August a year ago. I went to see him. And he was in the bank after my uncle died, and I resented that. I resented everything about him because he hated me so much through the years. And my aunt also raised him. But I went to see him in the hospital, and he was sitting on the side of the bed eating some grapes that I had brought him. And Mop and I walked out of the room and got on the elevator, and before our elevator got downstairs, he died. So I do feel like in a little way that maybe I did make amends where I held those resentments, even in AA. But he didn't get me drunk, but I found out he had a $500 bet that I would be drunk in 8 weeks, and he lost that, and that made him hate me that much worse than gold. But I didn't have any women down there to ask these questions to, but I asked them, and I just assumed it didn't matter to me anyway. I'd rather have had a man. I was blessed to have such a good sponsor, and I had the best in this country. And I asked him one day, I said, Ted, am I the only drunk woman in the state of Georgia? Around here? He said, no, one more. He said, you go over to your father and ask the Saliga and tell him who you are and tell him what you are. And he told me where to go. So I went hightailing over to see Saliga. And that was really a disappointment. She liked to get me drunk. If I hadn't called Ted right quick, she would have. I told her who I was, what I was, and she said, well, what's your problem? And I looked at her and I said, well, I don't know what to say. But the truth came out. I said, well, I'm having trouble trying to forget yesterday and quit worrying about tomorrow and just living today. Well, hell, that's why you're an alcoholic. And that's everything that woman said to me. And she got me drunk because I was expecting a little pity party, and I was expecting her to put her arms around me and cry and say, I am one too. But that's everything she said to me. I came home and called Ted, and he cackled. He laughed. He said, you don't want her for a sponsor? I said, no, don't want her for a sponsor. But Ted was getting pretty rough. Ted was pretty rough. He was good, and he identified me right away with the Sweetheart of the Cuthbert Group is how I got the name. Which I love that, but I never did have much luck with women alcoholics anyway. I could help the men, but I never could get the women to stay, stick with me. But I asked him one night, I said, what do y'all do in between meeting times? And Ted said, well, now let's see, you go to the bank in the morning. And another fella said, well, I'm going to tell you what I do before Ted tells you what to do. He said, when I came in here, I planted a red potato patch. And he said, I worked it with a spoon. And he said, I had one every year. So I plant me a petunia patch every year. I'll have my 19th petunia patch come March. I don't always work it with a spoon, but I just that much superstition. I'll get one and just work it around a little bit. And a dear Al-Anon down here 2 years ago made me a little scarecrow. And it said, bugs, beware of June's potato patch. I wouldn't take that. Mm-hmm. But Ted said, when you get home from the bank, you've got to stay busy. And he says, if you're not busy enough, call me. Anything. Well, I had, bless her heart, a good cook in that cafe. She was running the cafe while I was in the bank anyway. She knew the fix JT was in. And you know, JT would, when he would go down to Cuthbert with me on occasions, he would talk against AA. Or he would say something about me, and it would make Ted so mad. And Ted told me one day, he says, that son of a bitch is going to get me drunk. He just hated me. I did too. Well, I'd call him anyway. And so one night I had been, this cook told me he would sit out in front of the motel room in the afternoon. And we'd see him drinking. And when his head would get to a certain angle, you know, Francis would say, Miss June, his head right there now, let's go. And we'd go out and I'd get on one side and she'd get on the other and we'd haul him in there and undress him and put him in the bed. Pour him in the bed. And that went on my first year of trying to stay sober. And I believe if I stayed sober that year with Billy Buck in the bank, and J.T. drunk over the house every night, anybody could stay sober. Anybody. And there wasn't a single moment that I didn't ask God for that one day of sobriety and thanking that night. And nearly 19 years now have gone by, and I have yet to see anybody that's had a slip. If you ask them, if they ask God in the morning and thank Him that night, they've got. That's how simple it is, I think. Just if we don't do anything else. But, and that was about all I did that year, too. That and admit, take the first step. But he would tell me to sit down and shut up and listen. I wish he was here tonight, then, but the same thing. But one night, JT was passed out in the shower stall. And I couldn't get him out. And there were two bottles with a little bit in them, and I grabbed those two bottles right quick and dumped them in the commode. I was tempted, very much so this particular night. There were other bottles with a seal on them, but that didn't bother me, because I had heard somebody say you've got to take the seal and break the seal and so forth before you take the crime. I said, and JT's in there, passed out in the shower stall, and I can't get him out. He said, well, calm down, let me see. And he was, to those of you who knew Ted, he said, now, he talked slow, you know, and he said, now, let me tell you, you go in that way, in that shower stall, and you turn that water on in that shower stall, and you stand there a minute and pray that that comes to this train. I did it. But he didn't drink. He did die a year later, but he didn't drink that night. He died a year later. As I said one night, I didn't mean it like it sounded, he finally died. But I didn't really mean it like it sounded. I'm ready. But the desire for a drink left me immediately. And another time that I got desperate, so desperate for a drink, was just sitting there one night watching television. And, you know, I never did drink beer. I never did drink beer to get over a hangover. Well, I never did get over many hangovers because I just kept drinking. You know, I could get bone every day. I never was a periodic drinker. I think we are the blessed ones in Alcoholics Anonymous, too. The ones who drank daily can work this program daily easier than those who are periodic. That's my belief. I don't know. I wasn't a periodic drinker. Mine was every day. I never did come up for air. But one night, it had been raining in Lumpkin about 2 weeks. I'm going to tell this because it works. And anything will work if you use footwork. And that's what my sponsor told me to do, and I did it. And it had been raining pretty hard there for a couple of weeks, and that beer was pouring up on television. I thought, well, I mean, can't have that beer. My mouth watered. So I decided to use footwork, so I picked up my crochet. That didn't work. I picked up a book. I picked up the big book. That didn't work. I couldn't get anything out of the big book. And the more I thought about that beer, the more my mouth watered. And I went out in the yard, and I got the hose and started watering the lawn. And just bogging down that baby drink. And the night policeman stopped. And he pulled up, and he said, "Miss Juno, you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll tell you about it in the morning," and immediately this is how I left. So I don't think, if we do crazy things, so what? If it keeps us from taking a drink, I say stand on your head, do anything, but take that drink. Now, I was still, as I am today, asking God in the morning and thanking that night, and I had asked God that morning. And I think God might, a weak person like I am, I think maybe women alcoholics might be the weaker or the harder to stay sober. We're not supposed to even be drinking. The men are supposed to do that. I'm not a women who live anyway. I don't want to do what God did to us for a living. I don't want to get on the load and fall off and break an arm or leg or hip. I don't want to do what the men do. I said, let them stay where they are and let us stay where we are. Now I bet I got some enemies. But I was, as I said, I was doing everything they told me to do. I didn't weigh but 99 pounds. My eyes all sunk back in my head. And they told me, Ted says, get you some Hershey bars. Well, being me, I bought a case for the bank, a case for the restaurant, and a case for the house. And I had a case of Hershey bars in all three places, and I was eating Hershey bars all day long. And it wasn't but just a few weeks that I picked up about 12 or 15 pounds. And this old maid was working in the bank. And I mean, she's an old maid, too. She noticed that I was looking better. And I was taking the grapevine, and I was letting her read the grapevine, you know, and she was getting a lot out of that thing. And I never will forget, she put her arms up on the thing there on that, in the bank stall that day, and she said, she talked with shots, you know, she said, "Gee, how much would I have to drink to jump that?" And she wanted something I had. And I had something. I really did. I had a love that I had never known. I found a new life. I found a little maturity. I was immature in every way. Now, I wasn't a person to hold resentments ever in my life too long, except Bitterbug. And that's one exception. But I'd get mad at the devil with you, drunk or sober. But I'd soon forget it. It would pass off. I was not the type to hold them. But I did have to fight. I had to fight resentment. And that was something I'd never done. I never knew to do. I never knew anything. You see, Aunt Martha even wrote my love letters when I was in early 20s, when I was 21 or 2 years old. I never did anything for myself. And very, very immature in every way that you can be. She wanted me to make this trip to New York. And I wouldn't dare go. I wasn't going to get in a plane again. And this, I've been sober 4 years then. And she bribed me. She said, "If you'll go, I promise you I'll take you to the headquarters of AA." And I went, got on that jet plane, and coming back, we had to land way over the yonder in Birmingham because of the fog, and I was petrified. And Dan Martha is a good Christian woman. She says, "June, aren't you ready?" I said, "Hell no, I'm not ready." She said, "Well, when you get your feet on the ground, you better get ready." And but I still, if she can ask me that thing, I'm still not ready. But this program and you people have been my life. I don't know where I'd be today. And I want to throw this in there in case any of you might have a newcomer. Let's don't make that bad mistake. If we're sponsoring anybody, let's don't make them get up here where I am right now, so they get ready. Let's don't do that. That's bad. Let's wait till they're ready. After all, when they haven't got the 4 or 5 months of sobriety, how do they know what's like now? That prays on my mind right much. I wouldn't ever want to be a sponsor to anybody and push them, make them do something. Might get drunk on them. Might be why some of them have gotten drunk on them. Let's don't do that. But you know, I've got to have a sponsor, and you know, I adopted me one over at Eufaula. I think we still are kind of cunning in the back when they can get in here, don't we? I want to thank Nancy for you, because Nancy sure has been sweet. Nearly 19 years to let me love her husband. I figured maybe it would help him, too, for me to adopt him at the time that I did. And Courtney was over the cup one night, and my sponsor said, I don't believe I'm capable of sponsoring you. He had a little trouble. And he said, I mean, you know, I turned to Colton and I said, well, Colton, would you sponsor? And you know, he didn't say yes. He didn't say no. He didn't grunt. He didn't say anything but a few minutes he walked off. He was so scared he was going to have to sponsor me, he didn't know what to do. And I know Colton didn't want to be answering no telephone to his father. I don't know why I had to read this, because I've known it all my life. You have too. But you can hear it again. You haven't heard me read. I met a stranger in the night. His lamp ceased to shine. I paused and let him light his lamp by mine. At night a storm came up and shook the world about. And when it had died down, my lamp was out. And back to me the stranger came, and his lamp still glowing fine. He had retained that precious flame, and this time his lamp lit mine. Those of you who, I was a stranger, and my lamp was there, and those of you who were here when I came in are the ones that are responsible for me being here tonight. And all of you newcomers especially are responsible me being here tonight. This could very easily have gotten drunk last year or last month, but these newcomers have something. Well, they do. And I thank all of you. I love every one of you. And I thank my God for Alcoholics Anonymous.